sacrifice. And amen.
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 So, good morning. So I really appreciate you guys coming out. This is being recorded. That's kind of the bigger goal, is then to have this, to wrap up both quarters, have this audio on the website. Like I said in the email, someone from the previous quarter class said, hey, can you give, you know, more attention to depression? And so I wanted to in the most recent quarter, and decided instead, hey, let's really wrap up the material on anxiety and then do this extra thing. So people from both quarters are here invited to this class today. I tried to turn on the air. I hope that it is what it is. Okay, good. Feel free to just leave whenever you need to. I just appreciate you all being here. Start with Proverbs 15:15. All the days of the afflicted are evil, but the cheerful of heart has a continual feast. So, of course, the parallel lines there. All the days of the afflicted are evil. It doesn't mean moral evil, but difficult, hard, bad, right? And so oppressive are every day when you are afflicted, right? And so God understands these things. God understands that life is miserable when we are feeling afflicted. When we're afflicted, not just in our bodies, but especially then when in our hearts. And so the afflictions of the heart are one of the greatest burdens of life. God knows that. God understands that. And I think that one thing that this verse is really hitting at is how our burdens and our pain have such a coloring effect, right? That when it really impacts our heart and it really hits us, then it kind of gives our whole life a negative color, a different color. I think of Naomi in Ruth 1, right? Those hard things, and she says, no, my life is not sweet, my life is bitter. I'm not trying to say if she was depressed or not, but certainly that has colored her perspective on her life, right? Jeremiah and Job both cursed the day that they were born, right? My whole life has been bad. And that's just our nature as humans, is when things get really bad, it's gonna color everything. And it's just not normal for us to say, oh, well, you know, I'm going to have my last 20 years with chronic pain, but that's okay because my first 50 years were great. No, it's gonna be hard, right? Those are going to be difficult things. And what this verse really hits on is the power of negative feelings versus positive emotions, how powerful the negative things are. But if we can have a cheerful heart, then our whole life is colored positively. That's not easy by any means. But when we are able to do that, that the blessings that come from having a cheerful heart, and that may be on the other side of a great valley, a great pit in our life, coming to the other side of that. Okay, so what are the symptoms, when we talk about depression here, what are the symptoms we usually associate with depression?
Excessive sleeping.
Sleeping. Okay, so fatigue, tiredness. Good, good.
Loss of interest in things we used to enjoy.
Yes, loss of interest in things we used to enjoy. And so that always makes me think of, I have a good friend who's a preacher. We talk on a regular basis. And he was just telling me once, I think it was last winter, he's a little younger than me, so I would expect the like seasonal affected depression kind of thing to be less for him. But he's like, I'm not saying I'm depressed, it's just that I just don't enjoy the things I used to. I started smiling, I was like, so you're, yeah. So then he saw me smiling, he's like, is that like the textbook definition? I was like, yeah, that's like the textbook, you know. And so that's what I always think of with that, is when he said those literal words, you know. I love, good, what other symptoms?
Loss of appetite, or you want to eat everything.
Okay, yeah. So it could maybe affect your appetite in different ways. Sadness. Right, we typically associate depression with sadness, crying, tired, burdened, overwhelmed. Right, it's kind of it's that burden feel that then makes me just want to sleep. Kind of a shutting down effect. Despair and hopelessness, of course, that's stuck. And a stuck feeling is pretty crucial. We'll use that word a lot today, or trapped. So feeling empty, loss of interest, loss of pleasure in life, loss of pleasure in the things that used to be pleasurable. When I'm more depressed, that classical music, which has been my passion, my interest for years and years, doesn't quite do it for me. I need something, music that's a little more, punchy. Yeah. And so when I'm back into classical music, it's like, oh, I think my depression's better, you know, because it's just less punchy. Okay. Lacking motivation, right? Lacking drive. The blues, a low mood. So, you know, I purposefully made these slides be this kind of negative blue color. It's reminiscent of when we moved into our house here in Columbus, the house we've been in now for about 5 years. I said that the color of that basement was depression blue. Like, it was the worst. Like, who would paint a basement that color? It's already the basement. It doesn't need to be. It's very similar to this. Have you been in my basement recently? It's yellow now. I literally painted it to be yellow. Difficulty with attention, with concentration or decision making, affecting sleep, appetite, weight, energy, affect, right? Visibly telling that. So those are some symptoms that we normally associate with that. Not all these fit the stereotype, though, right? Stereotype of depression would maybe just be like you're sad all the time or something. But it doesn't even have to be sadness as much as just a down sense. It's easy to see from these symptoms that depression is a down, right? Maybe it's from the weight of long burdens. And so kind of the wearing down of, so especially, you know, longer term, feeling stuck or trapped. A component of depression would be things that you can't do something about, and so that leads to a trappedness, or you could do something about but don't. And we're going to then hit on this. This will be one of our key points towards the end of the class, is being stuck because you can't do something for various reasons. From inside out, crying helps me slow down and obsess over the weight of life's problems. Do you remember that quote from Inside Out? That I thought that was one of the standout quotes from that movie. I think there's probably some good in both Inside Out movies, but probably the greater genius was in that, the first movie. It has some good things in there. The down can be from being up, right? What goes up must come down. And our emotions have kind of a gravity to that, that the up thing is gonna come down. And the up could be from a variety of things, stress, anxiety, trauma, even on the other side of something exciting and good, right? That's, you win the gold medal, and then that's what you've been working towards, and then you're depressed afterwards, you know, that kind of thing, because of the excitement and the up and the goal and the focus and the loss of that goal then in your life. Okay, depression's common. Back in college, I remember then calling in my psychology class 20-something years ago, they called it the common cold of mental health, right? It's more common. But depression can be harder to notice than other mental health issues. And so you may not even notice it yourself. You could be in a fairly depressed state and not realize it. Now, other times it's like, no, it's pretty clear. So when I was, said something to the congregation a few years ago, thanking God for all he brought me through. And I shared at that point how I've been diagnosed, this is 8-ish years ago, with double depression. And that sounds fun. That's like, it's like, well, you know, you get your regular depression, but you're like a superpower there, right? So, and there it's very obvious, right? Double depression is like depression on top of depression. So that was noticeable, but it's not always that noticeable. And in fact, interestingly, you may not even want out of it. And that's different than other things, right? There's certain mental health things that are like, get me out, right? And depression, you may not want, you may be kind of bitter. And like, I don't want help. You know, I'm fine in this pool of bitterness, right? So depression, like everything else, here's our graphic from the quarter. Biopsychosocial. they all affect each other. I guess maybe I should have an arrow from the thinking over to the social, but you get the idea, right? Mind and body in relationship, important biopsychosocial and spiritual factors, right? So both quarters had us watch the Dr. Yapko video, where one of his big things is the social piece of depression. Depression is contagious. And I really think that the biopsychosocial model, just like all these other things of how God made us, is the best way to think about depression. And let's...
I'm sorry, I think I'm lost, but is the address here 4040?
Yes, it is. Are you dropping off something?
Yes,
or?
I have a DoorDash, but it's food and stuff, so I wasn't for sure.
Right. That doesn't sound
it's
right.
It's apartment number, but it gives us
that. Yeah, oh, so no, that's
those
apartments.
So when you leave here, go to the right,
okay,
and there's a whole apartment complex in there.
I'm sorry. I figured that's what it was, but I couldn't get him to answer, so.
Yeah.
I just wanted to check to make sure.
Absolutely. Sorry, no, yeah, you're welcome. Yeah. Yeah.
What does she have?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so remember the Dr. Yapko video where he was highlighting that people have tended to overemphasize the biological, but that the social aspect, that was, I think, probably some of the most helpful new information from Dr. Yapko was the social element of it, depression even being contagious with that. We all know that our thinking's off in anxiety, in addiction, and depression. The trick is, and you've heard me say this, the trick is how to think better. If your thinking is bad, how do you think better? And so you can tell a depressed person that's irrational, and they may say, well, I don't care, or, you know, or but I can't drop it. You know, that seems very true and real. So anyways, the social aspect, I think, is helpful that Yapko brought out. So some of the social elements of depression are not just current relationships, but past relationships. You may have learned from mom and dad how to handle stress, which is to shut down. You know, you didn't even realize, but that you learned from them how to handle life, which means I'm going to kind of fall into depression. We learn depressed thinking and emotions and behaviors from others. So all those things are key. So let's look at the biological factors, let's look at the thinking factors, let's look at the relationship factors, and of course in the spiritual, which is its own thing, but also impacts body and thinking and relationships all together.
I have a question.
Yes.
By that, we learn depressed thinking and emotions and behaviors. One of the things you're saying is we learn patterns of thinking which can lead to depression?
Maybe both. Okay. I mean, I think it would be you learn depressed.
Put us susceptible to it, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, but also I think that there's probably thinking that in itself is going to be depressing. Like, there's things that lead to depression, like, say, like lack of exercise.
Right.
But then there's things, like, if I learned a truth that nobody really loves me from my parents, if I learned when there's conflict, it's the end of the world. If I learn I run away from my problems by sleeping, like those are things that are going to be pretty much like directly.
I was thinking like if we grew up just hearing a lot of negative,
yes,
thinking, a lot of negative comments,
yes,
critical thinking, that kind of thing.
Then yes, and that would, I would think that, yeah, so at that point we don't need to necessarily parse out, is that making me depressed or did that just open the door for depression?
Right.
It's all kind of, you know, together, you know, kind of thing. But yes, I would think so. Versus learning optimism, right? Learning you can handle this. You know, learning everything's going to be okay. You know, like a faith response to stress,
so,
kind of thing.
So you either got tools or you didn't get tools, basically.
Or we're given bad tools.
Yeah, yeah. The opposite.
Yes.
Tools.
Yeah, tools that hurt you, yes. Good. Here's one interesting aspect of depression. I read this recently and it really resonated with how I think we're wired. Depression makes you more sensitive, less accurate. Important feature of depression, when you're depressed, you're more sensitive to relationship turbulence or maybe other things too, anxieties or fears or whatever, but you overestimate its importance. So do you see what we mean by more sensitive, less accurate? You're more sensitive to, oh, she's mad at me. or he's upset. But then you overestimate how big a deal it is.
We kind of call that paranoia sometimes.
Okay.
That's an aspect of it.
Sure, yeah, and I think so. Paranoia can be irrational or maybe more learned. But it you can sense something, and you're accurate. You're right. Yeah, he is mad. But it bothers you more than it needs to in terms of its importance. In other words, the depressed person is very good at noticing if their spouse or kids or parents or whatever. They're very good at noticing if they're upset or if they're happy, but then they perceive it as a bigger deal than it really is, right? That can create the walking on eggshells dynamic where, so then the depressed person, oh, don't be upset around them. It'll be the end of the world to them, you know, that kind of thing. So it's not that they're inaccurate. They can accurately sense if there's an issue, there's a problem, whatever. It's just that it registers as more of a real turbulence than it really is. Whereas a non-depressed person would say, well, my wife's upset with me, or my husband's upset with me, or my kids, and that's okay. Like, we'll get through this. Turbulence in relationships is normal. That's fine. That kind of thing. So the non-depressed mind is not hypersensitive to relationship turbulence, and it better understands that relationship turbulence is normal, not in itself a big deal. Does that make sense? Does that resonate with
yes.
with your all? I think it did. I read that recently. I was like, yep, I think that's right. Depression and anxiety often go hand in hand. You may have heard this terminology. Both are internalizing disorders, which is a withdrawal into the self. So depression, social withdrawal, worry, anxiety, somatic complaints, right? Like the kid who, my stomach hurts, they go to the nurse. Oh, that's just anxiety. All those are internalizing things, right? And so depression is a turning inward, is an internalizing disorder. Anxiety is the other things there. Well, the opposite of that would be what kind of disorder? Not internalizing, but
externalizing.
And that is acting out towards others, your environment. Aggression, hostility, hyperactivity, impulsivity, defiance, rule breaking. Those are all externalizing disorders. You may have already thought this. Guess which category women are more prone to?
Internalizing.
Wow, you guys are good. Okay, and guess which category men are more prone to?
Externalizing
disorders. So, I think this is my last Inside Out reference of the course. Okay, so in Inside Out, if you remember, how many of you seen that movie? Have you seen that movie? Okay. Do you remember when they go briefly into Dad's head? Which emotion is in the control seat in Dad's head? It's not joy. The kid, Riley, joy is in the control seat. But for Dad, do you remember which emotion is got the controls?
Anger,
that's right. So anger's in the middle, okay? And then in Mom's head, which emotion is in the control seat?
Is it anxiety in this movie? It's not, is it?
No, it's sadness. Sadness
Yeah,
is in
yeah.
the middle, yeah. Did you remember that? Yeah. And I read something about the writers, and they just said that kind of felt intuitively right. It's like, well, yeah, like that's just very normal. The man is very prone to anger, of course, in the movie even, in that scene, at that dinner scene, the dad explodes, and he's like, yeah, you stop that, you know. Whereas, you know, the mom is more sad. Well, that fits in what we're talking about here, right? The men be more prone to the externalizing of things, kick the dog, yell at the kids, and then the mom internalizing, more prone to depression, things like that. So, hey, okay, any thoughts on that?
I heard somebody say recently that a mom is only as happy as her saddest child.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's really true. And then I thought, oh, then that makes an idol out of the kids. That's not good, but I get that tendency that it's
yes.
hard to find joy for, I think, a woman in particular.
Yes.
Like, when I take that to Lawrence, he has a different emotion than I do.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, that is for real. Biologically, I may get some of the terminology wrong here, but when the mom is carrying the child's stem cells go through her whole body system and land in the heart. So literally, mothers are carrying in their heart traces of their children for every child that they've carried. It's like, folks want to like cry, right?
Yeah.
So they do. They carry around that in their heart, and in a way that men don't, which is God's design, that sometimes the men need to exercise that strength then in working with the kids, but then understanding where the mom is coming from with that. Okay, here's just another way of kind of looking at this. What dysfunction is being described in these bullet points? It involves biopsychosocial spiritual issues, all of which might need to be helped. To improve, a key action is to keep going, knowing it's going to be hard for a while, but you keep doing what you need to do. You'll need to wait while your brain reconfigures as you keep moving forward. Cry out to God in the suffering and do the opposite of what the dysfunction wants you to do. So who thinks that describes depression? Who thinks that describes anxiety? Something else? So the fact is really that this is the same template for both anxiety and depression. It looks different in terms of carrying it out, that the coping with and moving forward in anxiety looks very different than the moving forward in depression, but the same thing of keep going, it's gonna be hard, but keep doing the things you need to do, wait and do the opposite, is really gonna be the true for both of them. So there's a similarity. But differences in anxiety and depression, even though they're connected, they hang out together, they influence each other. Anxiety, of course, is an up, and depression is a down. You more easily tell you're anxious, it's less obvious. With depression, with anxiety, you want out. Like, what do I need to do? Yes?
Well, to give you another Disney reference to go with the last one. Frozen was great for that, with the do the next right thing.
Okay.
If you're depressed and you can't think about all of the choices you need to make, or your anxiety's too high, you just have to think of the next right thing.
Yes.
Like, what, and obviously with us being Christians, we take God's law into consideration, and what's the next right thing? What should I be doing? And not think about everything else outside of that.
Yes, yes, exactly. I guess that must be Frozen 2, because I haven't seen Frozen 2. Maybe I should see Frozen 2. They'll change everything. Should have seen that before the class. So absolutely, what does Jesus say? He says, don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow has enough problems. Focus on today, live your life one day at a time. And absolutely, I mean, if you're overwhelmed in depression and or anxiety, you just sometimes need to know, okay, what's the next thing to do? Okay, that's good. And then what's the next thing gonna do? And that just helping someone to see that or to do that can be very useful for them. Yeah, absolutely. With anxiety, you want out. What do I need to do to get out of this right now, right? Like, what trigger do I need to pull up, symbolically? What's the trigger I need to pull? What's the button I need to push to help me? Well, with depression, you may not feel that way at all. Right? Anxiety is more straightforward to deal with. Depression can be more complicated. I think there's just more things involved with it. But our principle of do the opposite, that does still apply. And so that's still such a useful principle. The trick is, okay, so what do you mean? Do the opposite this or is this, or how do I do the opposite? But kind of thinking from that perspective is still a useful lens. This is a quote from Jonathan Haidt, Anxious Generation, Vicious Cycles. Again, kind of talking about anxiety and depression together here. People are more likely to become depressed when they become or feel more socially disconnected, and depression then makes people feel less interested and able to seek out social connection. As with anxiety, there's a vicious cycle. So do you see that? So I'm less connected. That could be just because you go to Africa to preach, right? It could be you move to a new town, it doesn't matter. But you're, for whatever reason, good or bad, whatever, you become more socially disconnected. Well then, if I become depressed, then I have less interest in seeking out the help that would bless me, that would help me out of it, less interested and able to then get the social connection that I would need to bring me through this. And so that becomes a vicious cycle. And anxiety and depression both are very prone to kind of vicious cycles like that. Okay, this is a video. How many of you have seen this video? This is Johan Hari. It's okay. His other His other TED Talk has like 74 million hits. Like, it went viral. He says some good things here. In this 20-minute TED Talk, he is summarizing his book. His book is called Lost Connections. I think he says some good things in the TED Talk. I haven't read the book. I suspect he says some good things in the book. He's not a Christian. He's not coming at this from a Christian perspective. Sometimes that's useful because you see, oh, like even the world acknowledges X, Y, and Z. But in his video, he says some good things, but he also, you know, talks about human evolution, evolutionary psychology kind of things. But it's worth a watch, and I was kind of planning to show part of it, but for sake of time, we're not going to. But he's a journalist. He went all over the world, interviewed lots of people, you know, read all kinds of stuff. And his book gives 9 causes for depression that he kind of boiled it down to. 2 of them are biological. He mentioned the top genetics and brain chemistry. I don't know if that's the 2 that the book comes down to, but 2 biological causes. He mentions in the TED Talk additional things, not being out in nature, lack of autonomy, where you have no choice, right? Your job is, you're very stuck in that. You don't have flexibility. You are just told what to do. So lack of autonomy in the job. Loneliness causes depression. Well, that's almost kind of a no-brainer there. But his whole point is that we have needs that aren't being met. That's kind of his big line. So we need a sense of belonging. Life has meaning and purpose. People see you and value you and a future that makes sense. And when those aren't being met, especially in modern society where those aren't being met well, then of course people are going to be depressed. Western culture has such a rise of depression because these things, a sense you belong, life has meaning and purpose, people see you and value, and a future that makes sense, that's not in our world today. Now, we look at that. Are there any biblical principles in a sense you belong, life has meaning and purpose, people see you and value, and a future that makes sense? Yeah, very much. In fact, this last point, a future that makes sense, that's made me think of the book of Isaiah. You're in captivity, what is going on? And God says, look, here's what the future is going to look like. Here's what you're a part of. It's like, that's what God's giving them. He's giving them a sense of what's to come. Everything's going to be okay. I'm in control. He's giving them a future that makes sense. Do you think that maybe helped with their depression and captivity? Absolutely, right? Right.
Okay, wait, before you leave that.
Yep.
So is that future that makes sense in their situation, God was telling them what their future on earth was like? Is our future that makes sense to us more connected into eternity?
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, I think even Isaiah is ultimately talking about the kingdom to come that's going to be heaven. So yeah, I think either way, you know, so you may not live to the 70 years when people are going to return back to Israel, but you still have a sense of God's people are going to be okay, this hope of God's in control, those kind of truths. But for us, then yeah, that where Paul can, you know, say, I fought the good fight, I finished the race, I've kept the faith, there is a inheritance laid up for me that's coming. Instead of Job, we're like, this doesn't make sense. Things make a lot more sense to Paul. He's still perplexed, he says in 2 Corinthians. There's still perplexing things, but not despairing things. That's how he says, perplexed, but not despairing. So that difference. This is Johann. He says, problems are deeper than biology, so solutions need to go deeper too. He acknowledges the biological element. And he's really good in the video of saying, look, I've had a whole life of anxiety, depression. That made me want to figure out why. He said the chemicals, the pills helped me some, but did not solve it all. And so he says that the pills help some people some of the time. So, but there's just more to it than that. So I suspect there's good things in his book. It's hard to take a book like that too seriously when on the cover, the top endorsement is Elton John saying everyone needs to read this book or whatever, and you're like, you know, if it was like, you know, the head of the World Health Organization or something. But anyways, but I still suspect he has some these kind of things, right? These are what people need, and we see that being biblical. Okay, so in our quarter, we hit on lots of Bible principles, right? And we don't have time to rehash and go through all of that. We hit on the Elijah story, especially chapter 19, when Elijah has his years of stress, followed by a huge up of victory, followed by a hopelessness. Oh, all I've been through doesn't matter. Nothing's changed. And where Elijah finds himself. We talked about Job, who was certainly depressed. You talk about a coloring of your whole life, right? And all of those things. Jeremiah, same story. We talked about Jeremiah. We talked about Jeremiah more the first class cycle than the second class cycle. Then the psalmists who give us a wonderful model for how to handle our sadness, our misery, our downtimes. And so the psalms are so good with that. And really a lot of Old Testament poetry, Job, Ecclesiastes, and Lamentations are also very good. So this past Sunday did the Lamentations lesson, and just some of the principles there are very helpful for us, even incorporating them into today's class, of what you do in these times of when things are really awful, right? Here was the slide from before, where we talked about pouring your heart out, pouring your complaint out to God. Following the psalmist pattern of bringing our troubles to God and leaving them there and hoping in God helps us to feel our emotions instead of burying them, which is really important for us. Helps us move through our emotions instead of getting stuck in them. Gets us doing active things about our difficulties instead of being paralyzed and feeling hopeless about them. Helps us not feel alone, drawing us to God, who cares about us, is in control. And so I put this in the corner. This is an important slide, and I kept it there. I think this is an important slide. Following what the psalmists do, it helps us in these four ways, and even more than that, that to not bury these things, to feel them, move through them, do active things, trusting in God, and not feel so alone. So that's what we hit on before. So of course today, we won't plan today to hit on all the big points again from the whole quarter. But remember our big points: fill the void, right? Fill yourself up with your focus, fully commit, keep recommitting. It may take a long time, or it could be that in this life, the depression doesn't ease up like we would want it to. But that's okay when we continue to trust in God and just seek to be faithful as best we can through that depression. Here was our slide from the quarter on depression of doing the opposite. Depression wants to weigh us down. And so to grow out of it, we need to keep doing the things that help us move forward. Positive action, real action, not just busy work, but true things that help us. In many of our disorders, the word stuck is a good description, and we're gonna be hitting on that here in a minute. When we lack motivation, we need to learn to do things we know will help us in the long run. So I don't want to get exercise, right? I don't want to give up this thing, but that's really going to help me. So that perspective of, I sure don't have the motivation to fill in the blank. I do think that as Christians then, we should be able to find whether it's people in our life to help us do the next thing, whether it's God's word and the instructions about that. Those things should really help us where the world doesn't have that. You know, you're in the world, you're single, you don't have a lot of friends, you're trying to find someone to marry. Where do you find people to marry? At the bar? So you go to the bar to find, you're like, your life's pretty miserable, and you realize you gotta start doing more stuff to get out of your depression, but no one's there to make you do it, right? Whereas I would hope that Christians could then find the encouragement through each other, through God's word, through worship, through prayer, all those things, to help us keep going when we feel so weighed down. Depression wants us to hold on to things, and to grow out of it, we let God meet us in our depression. So the point is not, you just need to shape up. The point is, why do you have so many problems? God knows our suffering. God knows what we've been through. God meets us there and comforts us there. And then when that has been sufficiently dealt with, and that's between, you know, ultimately you and God, then God says, okay, now let's get you moving forward. Let's get you out of this. And then we need to then let God do that. So God and his people want to meet you where you're at, meet you with compassion, but then to help you move forward with that. And so I think that again, God's ways are so powerful for us in these things. So again, that's from last quarter. If you were in that class that day, you saw that slide. So today, let's focus on some practical strategies for dealing with the depression. Remember, our goal is to deal with the whole person, so all the interconnected bio, psycho, social, spiritual parts of how God made us. And sometimes we are resistant to certain kinds of help. You name it, each of us are going to be a certain kind of help. We're like, well, don't tell me that, you know. I don't want to do that. So we have a dynamic in our thinking today, not just as Americans, but also as Christians, of, oh, it's never biological, oh, it's only biological. And I do hope that after this quarter, we've seen, oh, it very well could be biological, but it's not limited to only that. I mean, that could be. We don't know. Every situation is unique. So we don't want to say it's never biological. We don't want to say it's only biological. That just doesn't seem wise now that we have seen the bigger picture of how God made us and how God helps us. I'm going to tell a story. You can find it on YouTube. Bill O'Hanlon is the guy who repeats it. He studied under Milton Erickson, who was a big deal in the 20th century in the world of psychology. This is a story about Milton Erickson, but I think it's helpful to, instead of finding this story on a random blog, to see it as told by Bill O'Hanlon, because he studied under Milton Erickson. It's the African Violet Queen story. Have any of you heard the story before? Is this familiar to? So the internet loves this story. Therapists love this story. This is the kind of story that, you know, they'll tell at a psychology convention and everyone's crying at the end of it, you know, kind of thing. So this is a true story of a lady in Milwaukee who got connected with Milton Erickson, and Erickson goes over to visit her. She shows up at the door in a wheelchair. So she had recently come into really deep depression, and it was her nephew, I think, who said, "Erickson, will you come and visit her?" So in her recent sickness and being wheelchair bound, she found herself very isolated. This is the 1950s when things weren't as convenient for people in wheelchairs. I think probably more of a social stigma with that. Not married, no kids, so no one in her life, but she's got a lot of money. And so she is, you know, talking to Milton Erickson, showing him around the house and talking about her life. And one of the things she shared was how she had been a churchgoer, but once she was wheelchair bound in her recent health problems, she feels really stupid. She doesn't want to be seen in the wheelchair. So she was going to church, but she would show up late. She has to have her, you know, helper guy, I mean, house paid servant or whatever, like help her into the car, help her into the church building. And then she's leaving like right afterwards. So she's very disconnected. She's also feeling very ashamed, like just feeling really ashamed of her condition. Doesn't want people to even see her in that, feeling embarrassed about that. So that has contributed to this downward spiral in her life. So one of the last places that she takes Erickson as she's wheeling through her house, and they're kind of showing off her house, takes her to the greenhouse, and she is nursing an African violet. And she's taking cuttings from that and starting other African violets, which is difficult to do. And so Milton's impressed with that. She is telling him about that. And so after kind of getting a glimpse of her life, Erickson says, well, definitely learn about your situation. And I think one of your problems here is you're not being a very good Christian. She says, what? She's all taken aback by that. He says, you know, you got all this money, but you need to be sharing it. So he says, here's your assignment, is get a church bulletin, and every person that you find out has a loss, a family member, a loss of a loved one, I want you to go and bring them an African violet. You are good at growing these. Show up at their doorstep in person and give your condolences. And in the church bulletin, every birth or positive announcement, go give your congratulations in person. And, you know, that's your job. So years pass, and what Bill O'Hanlon says is in his, like, I don't know, records or whatever. He has the newspaper clipping of the Milwaukee newspaper. When she died, hundreds of people showed up at her funeral, right? Just hundreds and hundreds, because, and they called her the African Violet Queen because of all the hundreds of people that she had served and given that to and comforted, and the real connection, right, that she had made. And so instead of her life being alone, she ended up with all these connections because of the help that she had given. Okay, so this is a great story, true story. I'm sure, I mean, the internet loves this story. You can Google African Violet Queen. I'm sure you can even find the Milwaukee newspaper that you know was from the 70s, whatever, that was the kind of the follow-up punchline of the story. But it shows the need for community, need for human connection, shows the power of compassion and the power of joy and the power of purpose, right? But here's why I bring up that story. I think it's a great story. People like that story. But I think that many Christians would not respond well to similar advice. And I don't even mean where he said the line, I don't think you're being a very good Christian. I just mean in general sense of, I think a lot of Christians would say, no, you're not giving her the most encouraging advice. Or that I think in our attempt to be sympathetic to people, or because of our own challenge we faced or whatever, might think that wasn't good advice. But yeah, I think that was good advice. So here's what's interesting is that Bill O'Hanlon, as he tells the story that Milton Erickson told his students, he asked him about it. What gave you that advice? Well, what came to your head to kind of give her that advice, that's what she needed to do, is use those African violets to then be a blessing to others? And apparently Erickson sat there and thought for a minute, and he said, I saw her life in the pit she was in, or whatever the terminology. He said, I thought it would be easier for her to grow that life than to weed out all the depression. So, you know, instead of trying to address all the little things, here's some good things, here's some life.
Fill the void.
Fill the void, yeah, use that. That's already going, you know, use that. So, anyway, so some good thoughts there. And I think the point is, sometimes we have good advice for people that maybe even feels not pleasant to hear, but it is going to be helpful for them. Okay, so some practical steps. In depression, is focus on what you know to be true. Not my emotions, not my down thoughts, right? This was a big point that Dr. Yapko made, right? He called it doing a reality check. I guess that's maybe a subsequent slide. But don't listen to your emotions, right? Your down thoughts. It may feel very real, but work hard to think, is this really the situation? We can know God's word is true, and so we can cling to that. So that was Lamentations 3, the sermon from Sunday. And you remember, what's the basic storyline? If Lamentations 3 has a story arc to it, what's the Lamentations 3 story? Yeah, but the story he goes through, the first 20 or so verses are everything's awful. Yeah. Terrible, terrible, terrible. He says, but this I call to mind, and it's that truth, that the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases, his mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion. I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him. He keeps going. And so then he says, I'm going to cling to that truth. And he says, you know what, here's the hidden realities. God doesn't delight in punishing us, and God is not unjust. And then he says, here's what's going to happen. God will bring out the righteous. God will bring down the wicked. And so it's kind of this thought trajectory of him saying, things are awful, but I'm going to call this to mind, right? So that kind of thing. So when we're anxious, depressed, ashamed, addicted, etc., there's all kinds of ways we're not thinking right. And we may not be able to think our way out of the pit, but there are still some truths we can cling to. So as much as we can to have that thinking piece, the cognitive piece, what are some truths I can cling to? And even if you're like, well, yeah, but since I've been in the pit, I'm doubting God, and I'm doubting the Bible, and all those compounding kind of issues. But the other truths you can cling to are things like, you know, when things were better, you did believe in God. And there have been things in your life that God has helped you through. And there are still things you can be reminded of that are true, even in the compounding of a feeling so far from God, right? And so I don't feel like anything matters, but I can trust in God's word. Apparently, things do matter. I'll get back to there eventually, right? And so what are some truths I can cling to? So yeah, here's the Dr. Yapko. Remember how Dr. Yapko talked about telling yourself the truth, do that reality check, right? So don't listen to your emotions. That's not what we want to. And don't be led by those cognitive distortions, all or nothing thinking, rejecting the positive. You know, I'm terrible at my job. No, you know, it feels that way. And I get that. I've been there too. But the reality is you're pretty good at your job most days. And this failure isn't everything. You know, that's all or nothing thinking. Yeah. Here's a pretty good chart about depressed thinking. This is just one of those memes that goes around the internet. But ways depression brainwashes you. Perceived burdensomeness. I make their lives harder by being this way, right? That they don't want to help me. Like, well, let's evaluate that. Isolation, I don't belong with my loved ones anymore. And these are, again, things you feel. There's a cognitive element to it, but it's also very felt. Minimizing, sure, I've done great things, but other people are better. Overgeneralization, I failed at this thing, so I'm a failure at life. End quotation. Catastrophizing, they aren't texting me back because they hate me. And that sounds just like Yapko, right? I didn't get a text back, and so everything's awful. Apathy, I don't have passions or interests. I'm boring and lazy. So, you know, discounting the positive is connected to some of these things, right?
Minimizing. Where did you find this on the internet?
On the internet, memes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Now, there's a link there to, anxiety, support, recovery. Yeah. Now, it's always worth occasionally just going back and finding a website that is a list of good cognitive distortions, just those good old cognitive distortions of different ways that we, aren't thinking fairly, aren't thinking right. It's so easy to do. It may be more of the emotional than rational, but that's very much where we're at. But it is important for us to try to evaluate those truths. Is that really true, even if it feels true? And are there some deeper truths that I can cling to, right? This is very much, so the Lamentations 3 sermon on Sunday, here's a very similar portrait in Psalm 42. All of Psalm 42 and Psalm 43 is part of the same psalm, actually. It's a bad division there. But we know some of these words because we sing them. As the deer pants for flowing streams, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? My tears have been my food day and night, while they say to me all day long, where is your God? These things I remember as I pour out my soul, how I go with the throng and lead them in procession to the house of God, with glad shouts and songs of praise, a multitude-keeping festival. Why are you cast down, O my soul, and why are you in turmoil within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my salvation and my God. Now, that's a psalm for the depressed, right? I think there's a lot in there of depressed kind of thinking. What jumps out to you? Well, I'll just say this. We sing as the deer, and it's this really pretty song about how much we love God. The context is a much more down place, right? What jumps out to you from, that's just verses 1-6, that connects to the kinds of things we've been talking about with depression? Yeah.
My tears have been my food day and night.
So yes.
The sadness with the tears and then kind of eating habits.
Like, yeah, kind of unable to stop it kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely.
What I used to do.
And you see that kind of optimistic, it used to be perfect, right?
Which is a cognitive distortion.
Well, we all do. That's nostalgia. You know, things were just great back in first grade. You know,
The good old days.
Yeah.
The 50s were the good old days.
Yes, absolutely.
They never happened wrong. That was wrong.
That's right. Yes, exactly. You're exactly right. So that thinking, I used to go with the throng, lead them in the procession, glad shouts on. They were happy. Again, there's kind of like, those people are happy, I'm not, right? They're happy, I'll never be that. Glad shouts, songs of praise, a multitude-keeping festival. So this kind of, they're happy, not me, that things were good and now they're bad. Very common to feel that way, right?
They say, where is your God?
Yes, isolation, and that's a shame thing too, right? This is they're mocking him, you know. So it's a very, the social element, and tried to hit on that in our quarter, was how the social element is probably more important than we give credit for. Of when people are, you know, mocking you in your faith, in your pain, that's very down. That's very discouraging.
Well, and that's also whatever that. It doesn't have to be someone actually saying to me in my pain, "Oh, Heather, where's your God now?" You know, it could just be the pain itself. Like, you're in so much pain, where's your God? He's supposed to make you not feel pain. Or whatever the circumstance is, could be personified as saying, "Where's your God?"
Mm, yes, yes, not even using those words. Good. Yeah, so my tears have been my food day and night. Now here I think is the key. Why are you cast down on my soul? Why are you in turmoil within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my salvation and my God. Now, obviously, this psalm is not dealing with every aspect of depression or every situation we might find ourselves in. But what's really good about that, those last three lines?
I'm down, but I can look forward and say, hope. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Why are you cast down? Why are you in turmoil? He's looking in, and then he's going to say, I'm going to choose. And what's literally, what's the verbiage here? He says, hope in God. Who's he saying that to?
To himself.
To himself, to his soul, right? Mm-hmm. Hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my salvation, my God. So he's putting his hope in God, but he's kind of having to tell himself that, right? Mm-hmm. It's not coming easily. He's having to tell himself that and seek and hold that truth through the pain, through the isolation and all of that, right? So he's talking to his soul, he's talking to his thoughts, he's talking to his emotions. Another way of saying that is he doesn't let his thoughts and emotions lead him, he leads them. When you put it in that perspective, really Psalm 42 here is very similar to Lamentations 3, where he says, things are awful, things are awful, God's punishing, it's awful, awful. But this I call to mind, I'm going to choose this. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. Okay, I'm going to hope in him. I'm going to choose that. So that's what we're going to have to do, is cling to truth as best we can through it. And God can give us the strength to do that. God hasn't said our life's going to be easy, but he has said, I'll give you the strength to be faithful through the trial. I'll give you the strength to be faithful through the depression or through the shame and through the battle and whatever it is. So I think some really helpful things there. We're going to have to tell ourselves these truths, and we have to do it over and over again. So here's just another little anecdote. About a year ago, I did a gospel meeting in Tuscaloosa, and a lady was there who couldn't be there Friday night or Saturday night, but she was there on Sunday for the lessons. And I'd heard about her from the Christians talking about, and I'd heard that she had just gone through a really hard, being her husband's caretaker for a long time, very difficult, until he passed. He recently passed, and so she's not his caretaker anymore. So this lady is a therapist. She's a therapist, find out she's specifically cognitive behavioral therapist. And so she comes to me after the morning sermons, and she says, you know, I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist, and your lessons have so much stuff of cognitive behavioral therapy in it. And I'd be like, well, I'm like, there's a reason for that. But I didn't like go into my, you know, life story with her or anything. But then she started talking about how when she was taking care of her husband for months and months, she said, I just had to keep telling myself the truth. I had to say, I'm a warrior. I'm strong. You know, I can do this, or whatever it was. And she said, I have to keep telling myself that. And that's, of course, like some of the essence of cognitive behavioral therapy is telling yourself the truth. Cognitive behavioral therapy in itself, I think, has some weaknesses that God's word even helps us with even more. But just that idea of Lamentations 3 or Psalm 42 is, I'm going to just have to keep telling myself the truth through this time of difficulty. Okay, so comments or thoughts on that?
Well, I think where God's word comes into it is, I am strong, I can do this, I, you know, all of the things.
but it's because of God.
Yes.
Because he's with me. He's standing beside me. He's the one that's helping me.
Absolutely.
It's not really me. It's him.
Absolutely. Yes. And that is, again, an advantage we should have over the world, because they look inside and realize, I don't have the strength. I don't got this. So what are they left with? They're left with kind of positive self-help aphorisms. You look yourself in the mirror and say, you can do it. You can. You got this, right? And as a Christian, I'm like, that's so empty.
Yeah.
We both look inside and say, I don't got this. But we can say, God will help me through. And the world has to kind of conjure that up. I think what we've seen is that is just going to be way less helpful. You know, I don't mean that doesn't help some people. Some people love that stuff, right? The YouTube videos, you're the wolf, you know, and go. And I watch those. I'm like, this does nothing for me. I'm not a wolf, you know. All those feed the wolf. Okay, anyways. So yeah, so that's absolutely right. Is we don't got this. My help will come from God. He'll bring me through. So why are you cast down? You got this. You are strong enough. No. Why are you cast down? Because you can hope in God, and God will bring you through. God's the one who's in control, not me. Okay, very good. Okay, second practical thing is help the downs, feed the ups. I mean, kind of common sense, but just helpful to think through. I'm going to use the visual from the cover of Soul of Shame here for this guy. He seemed pretty burdened, and my software didn't come with any better picture. So I'm going to use that. Help the down. So what are some different downs that we might feel when we are depressed? In sense of like burdens, weights, what might be some things we put on that list?
Helplessness.
Helplessness. Good. Yes. And that is a good word that might resonate better for some people. When I put stuck up here, that's probably very connected to that. Yeah. What else might be a down?
Uselessness,
which has a shame element, right? Internalized worthlessness. So stress can be that down, right? The long-term chronic stress. The can'ts. We'll hit on this more in a minute, but all the things I can't do, whether that's an external force that keeps me from being able to do something, or if that's an internal force that keeps me, but all those can'ts, which connects to helplessness, and connects to, you didn't say worthlessness, you said uselessness.
Yeah.
Anxiety, of course, can end up being that burden. Relationships, of course. Isolation from people. Hurt from people, right? Instead of a heart filled with love, you have a heart filled with, I'm worthless, I'm garbage, I was abused, I was neglected, I was hurt, my childhood was garbage, my marriage was garbage, I mean, you name it, right? So there's relationships that hurt. And then pain. You know, chronic pain is just going to be a downer. You know, that's just kind of almost inevitable with that. So help the downs, feed the ups. So what might be some ups that will help us in this? And I'm trying on this chart a little bit to kind of give the opposite. So like what would the opposite of stress be? What would the opposite of a can't sense be? What would the opposite of pain be? Any thoughts on what might be the opposite of stress?
Calm.
I put rest, but yeah, I mean, you know, calmness and rest, pretty similar there. Yeah, maybe help even. Help through something stressful. Okay, so what's the opposite of a can't? Where I'm not doing something, I can't do this thing, my inactivity, that may be kind of a giveaway. What would maybe the opposite of that be?
Do something.
Yeah, action. Action just so often helps, okay? What would opposite of anxiety be? There's no one perfect answer. Peace, yeah, rest. What'd you say?
Trust,
yeah, good, yeah. Do not fear, have faith. Good. Freedom, I think, is a helpful word. Anxiety, I'm being controlled by the fear, as opposed to I have the strength and the freedom to do what I want to do, what I should do, what needs to be done, etc. Freedom's a really helpful word with depression. Opposite of relationships. So instead of bad relationships, good relationships, right? Connection, love, support, community, you know, all those things. And then opposite of pain might be
healing.
Calmness, rest again is connected, right? I put joy. There may be better opposites, but that kind of idea. The things in this category, kind of, these things wear away hope, right? Stress wears away hope. Anxiety wears away hope. Whereas these things build hope, right? And I know you've all had this. Life is really hard, stressful, discouraging. You're tired. And you get that one night of really good sleep. And you wake up and you're like, I think I can do this. Like, I think my life could be manageable again, you know. All it took was some good rest. You know, we've had that. And so you're like, wow, that was a very hope-building night of rest. But those things do. They really help us feel better about that. So these things build hope, joy, good relationships, a freedom to do what needs to be done, you know, things like that. Freedom, we'll hit on at the end. But in a lot of ways, I think freedom is the opposite of so many of these dysfunctional mental health issues, is the freedom to do what needs to be done, the freedom to do and the strength to do what I can do to fill my role, etc. And when you are very anxious and very depressed, you don't feel free. You feel very burdened, stuck, trapped, hopeless, worthless, can't do anything, you know, kind of thing. Okay, I grabbed this slide. That's with the color change. I grabbed this from the How We Help Each Other unit, but I put it in here. 1 Thessalonians 5:14. And we urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. And what this shows us so clearly is different people need different kinds of responses, right? So he gives three different categories, then he says be patient with them all. So when people are being rebellious, that's this idle, right? Kind of intentionally not doing what's right. What do they need?
Admonition,
rebuke, correction, warning, right, etc. Okay, when people are discouraged and faint-hearted, what do they need?
Encouragement.
Gentleness, I think, with that, right? They're feeling overwhelmed or discouraged. Well, they need that encouragement. And then when people are weak, they need
support,
help, right? Hands-on care, strengthening, their needs met, etc. Those are all good words. Well, what happens? And patience with everybody. What happens if I mishandle these situations? Someone needs to be rebuked, but you just kind of help them or try to encourage them when it's the not kind of that situation.
You're gonna make it worse.
Yeah, you're not giving them the push that they need, right? And so we'll see that. Okay, so what if someone is moving and asks, can people come over on Saturday morning? I'm putting that, well, no, you tell me, what category is that?
Admonish with
them. Yeah, stop moving.
Well, they're weak anyway.
That's exactly it. It is, and so they need help, right? Yeah. So they have a lot of heavy things to lift, and they can't move them and lift them by themselves. So help, okay. So you say to them, wow, it sounds like this move is really hard for you. And you know, I'll be praying about this for you. And I really want to give you encouragement you need. You're like, no, like I just need help. Like, well, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So my point is, that's an example of someone needs help. And you're like, oh, I'll give them encouragement. Well, no, sometimes they just need hands-on help, right? And so that's very different. Someone's discouraged about their job situation. They may not need help. They maybe just need encouragement, right? Someone to talk to. They don't need to do anything other than just help me not feel alone or whatever, right? Or someone's causing trouble at church by gossiping. Well, that's an admonishment situation, right? And so they aren't needing help. They're not needing encouragement. They need patience as you're trying to help them be pleasing to the Lord. But they may need to be, they're going to need to be warned about that or rebuked or whatever. Okay, so often the depressed person just needs help, right? They don't need encouragement. Maybe they just need hands-on help. They're like the donkey stuck under the load, right? You've surely thought about that donkey, right? Exodus 23:5. You see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden. And it's just stuck there. It's on the road. It can't get up, right? You shall refrain from leaving him with it. You've rescued the donkey with it. Help the guy get his donkey back and his stuff back, you know. And sometimes that's the depressed person. They're just under that heavy load, and they just need help, right? And it's not even so much that they need encouragement, although obviously we're going to need that, but it could just be that they need help with stuff, right? Isaiah 58:6, is this not the fast, the fast that I want? Help people, loose the bonds of the wickedness, undo the straps of the yoke, let the oppressed go free, break every yoke. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, bring the homeless poor into your house, when you see the naked, cover him? So, you know, what God wants us is not just to help people when they're feeling burdened, to maybe that's hands-on care, you know, whatever. So what the whole point of this, though, is to help those down things and then feed the up things. And so, you know, how can I help the stress, reduce the stress or the cancer, the anxiety, the bad relationship, the pain? So that's like a whole way of approaching it. But the other side of it is try to feed the ups, right? Maybe I need rest. I may need to take some action. Grow in a way to where you have strength to have the freedom that you need to do the right things here. Better relationships, joy. Now, here's my point, though, with this chart is sometimes the same things that help alleviate the downs are also feeding the up. It's not like here's one kind of thing. Here. So, for example, coffee with a friend. Is that going to maybe alleviate the down? Yeah. You know, in terms of someone to talk to, whatever. And then at the same time, can that also then help the up, right? Right. A good night of sleep, can that maybe help the down? Can it also then, alleviate the down, help the up? Yeah. Productive work on a looming project. Is that helping the down? Yes. Is it helping the up? Yeah, so that's the idea, is thinking ways of what can I do to alleviate the bad stuff, but also feed the good stuff. And it doesn't have to be one or the other. It could be both, right? Just in terms of comparing depression to anxiety, depression will usually take more active ups than anxiety will need active downs. And here's what I mean by that, is if you're depressed, you might need to be doing some active things to get back up to normal. Things like exercise, things like relationships, coffee with a friend, worship, all those things that you're having to do to get up. Whereas with anxiety, you might need to do things that intentionally relax you. You might need to do intentionally relaxing things, but part of anxiety is also letting your mind learn to relax by itself, learn to sell by itself. So that's the idea. Depression, we usually take more active ups than anxiety needs active downs. When anxiety is up, part of the recovery is letting the brain calm down by itself without specifically trying to help it. Whereas depression, on the other hand, may need more active choices to get up out of feeling so down. Your brain may not naturally get back to baseline without helping it up, you know. So some people in their anxiety do need to do relaxing things. There's a preacher I talked to that would get panic attacks, and he loves progressive muscle relaxation, PMR. Where you tense your muscles and relax them, you go through the body and do that. That doesn't do much for me. He loves that. Oh, he loves that. That's fine. That's a helpful thing for him. But a lot of anxiety is actually learning to just let your brain settle without doing something. It's the doing something that's keeping you up. So that is more situation dependent. Whereas in depression, it may be you need to actively do some things to get you back up to baseline. In both cases, you're still doing the opposite, by the way. It's still the same principle. Okay, and our third point for today, and then we'll wrap this up, is we feed depression when I can't do something or I don't do anything. And that's the idea of stuckness. Stuckness or feeling trapped is a key factor for depression. You may be stuck in a bad situation that feels hopeless. Proverbs 13:12. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. A desire fulfilled is the tree of life. you've been hoping for this thing, you've been hoping for this thing, and then it doesn't come. I remember there was some specific medical appointment, some doctor's appointment years ago. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was for Julianne. It was like, oh, this is going to be helpful. We're looking forward. And of course, it's months away, and then it's weeks away, and then it's days away, and then it gets canceled. And you're like, oh, and you have to wait longer, you know, all those things. So I just remember that being a specific memory. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. So stuck in a bad situation, feeling hopeless, right? Lack of autonomy in your job is a trappedness or a stuckness. Lack of motivation that leads to further lack of motivation. That downward spiral is a very stuck situation. And so it could be something you have control over, like I can't do something because I lack the strength to do, like the motivation, or it could be something you don't have control over, like your job, or you know, if this was 300 years ago, your dad was a shoemaker, you're a shoemaker, I'm stuck being a shoemaker, like that's what my life's going to be. So that stuckness can be very depressing. Jesus himself felt the burden of the inevitable cross, right? He knew that's where he was going. It loomed ahead of him, it loomed over him, and that's hard. That's a burden to bear when you know that that hard thing is coming. Look at Jesus' words here on a couple occasions. Luke 12, 49. I came to cast fire on the earth, and would that it were already kindled. Oh, I wish I could get over with. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it's accomplished. You see that? He knew it was coming. He couldn't get out of it. I think, was it Thursday night we talked about this principle? Jesus like knew he was going to die. And that's very stressful. There's not going to be any way out of it. This is where and how I'm going to die. And how great is my distress until it's accomplished. You see that? It's hard. It's looming. It's inescapable. And that inescapable, that's just a big word for stuck. You know, that he is trapped in that sense of what he has to go through. Closer to the end is the week of the week of his passion in John 12, 27. Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose, I've come to this hour. So just even leading up to it. And maybe we don't think about that side of Jesus much, but of just how when you know that this is going to happen and that it's going to be very difficult, being stuck in that is a challenge. Now, he handled that perfectly, of course, but that's going to be a burden. It's going to be a hard thing, going to be a temptation then to handle poorly. So Jesus himself felt the burden of the inevitable cross that loomed ahead of him. Jesus always did the right thing, but that doesn't mean that looking ahead to the cross or other elements of his life weren't an emotional and psychological burden, right? Those were hard things. This is the prophet speaking of Jesus' situation, anticipating that. Isaiah 49:4. But I said, I've labored in vain. I've spent my strength for nothing and vanity. That's discouragement. And Jesus felt that at times. This feels so vain and pointless. Oh, how long am I to bear with you, faithless generation? How long am I to deal with you? Progress.
Response.
Yeah.
Right. The wrong response. Or the,
yeah.
You know, resistance and.
Yes.
Even the people closest to you.
Yes. Don't, yes. Don't we would, if I was one of the 12, I would have driven Jesus crazy, mm-hmm. right? You know, that kind of thing, right? Jesus, later in Isaiah, he was despised, rejected of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. You know, so that kind of, that was a lot of what Jesus' life was. Let me give an example of this as a personal example, that my medical bill paperwork is just a burden because we're a part of a Christian Medishare thing, so it's like I'm my own insurance agent, right? So it's the paying of the bills, but then it's also the processing of the bills that get piled up, and then I'm negotiating then with them and figuring things out, and they drop the ball. They're very frustrating to deal with. So it's this looming, painful process. And so I felt very stuck in that, very overwhelmed. It was very anxiety producing. It's easy to put off. You have to like work up the emotions to like jump into it, right? If I got 20 minutes, I can't just jump into this for 20 minutes, right? It's too big of a thing. A lot of shame involved, right? Like all different things, right? So this project started looming bigger and bigger in my mind, more and more overwhelming. I feel very overwhelmed. It becomes very depressing. So then I start working on it, chiseling away at it, and it's awful. It's miserable. I'm having 90-minute long conversation on the phone with these people, 2-hour long conversation on the phone with these people, right? So I need help. So I asked Rob Reeves for help. I was like, I need help. I need help. Rob just is going to need to come over here and like do help me here, right? Because he's an accountant, right? I asked him for help. I was like, and Rob knows about like my OCD stuff. He'll be gracious. He'll be compassionate. Okay. So I asked him for help. Rob, of course, said yes. Glad to help, right? So before Rob came, I was like, well, I have to do my part. Like maybe he'll come on Saturday, but there's some stuff I can do, right? I need to do this. I can take care of this. I start working on it, the pieces I can. I make more and more progress. Okay, I can do this before Rob comes. I can keep working on that. Well, Rob's never had to come because I was able to do the little parts. But just knowing that there was help, okay, if this becomes too overwhelming, like, I'm not going to drown in this. Someone else can help. That was very empowering to where, okay, I was able to chisel away. Now, there's a chance he could still need to come over for some piece of it, but just his willingness to help and knowing that there's that was very encouraging and then helped me to make the steps so it didn't just loom so big in my mind, right? So
we have to be willing to ask people because a lot of times we don't know what everybody's going through. And so we have to be a little transparent about needing help.
Yes, yes. Do you remember when Roger Polanco in his gospel meeting here, he talked about the guy they were studying with, maybe with Caleb, studying with this guy, and the guy's like, could you come over and help me clean my house? And they're like, sure. Like that's kind of an odd, like no one's asked us that before. And they show up and he's a hoarder, right? Yeah. And he just can't handle it. To throw all that stuff away, he's gonna need help, right? And he felt very burdened by that, very ashamed by that. And of course, they handled it well, they helped him, he became a Christian, like a great story. But you know, we've maybe been there, been like, I need help, like I need to reach out. And so then, whether or not they even need to come over and help, one very empowering and encouraging thing is that the people are willing to help and that you're able to go to someone, right?
So yep. I think often about something Edwin Crozier said many years ago. He said, and I'm not going to get it exactly right, but if nobody ever shares what they need, then nobody ever gets to fulfill Galatians 6.
Mm-hmm. Bear one of those burdens, yeah.
Exactly. And we just don't really have the right to rob others of those opportunities.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, very good. Very good. So one of the hidden stuckness, and this I think is a helpful thing to think through. One is our inner emotional barriers, our emotional hindrances, my emotional hangups, where I'm giving myself the stuckness.
Yeah.
I can't do anything. So, you know, if it's my medical bill paperwork, that's one thing. But you may be in a relationship where you're like, I can't do anything. It could be that that's true of that person, but it really could be that I can't handle doing something because if I bring that up, it'll be World War III. If I bring that up, it'll, you know, upset everybody in the family, etc. And so it's kind of like I'm not acting out of freedom. I'm not able to do anything because I couldn't handle the repercussions. And so my own emotional situation, my own hangups, is creating my own stuckness. That's very depressing. That's very hard, right? So there's a world of difference between a wife who chooses not to say something to her husband out of strength, right? We'll talk about that later. We'll delay that. I'll bring that up at a better time. I can let that go. Versus the wife who can't say something because she's got emotional barriers. She's got hangups that help her from having a good conversation. Husband could be the same way, right? It could be both. There's a guy I'm talking to right now who part of his depression is, I think he needs his wife to be stable for him. And we've probably been there. At least a lot of guys have been there. I need my wife to be stable. Well, so I can't bring up stuff because then if she gets upset, then I get upset and the whole thing. Well, what you kind of realize there is, oh, okay, I need to be more stable here so that if I bring something up and it doesn't go well, it'll be okay. Like I can be more stable, but then I'm doing that out of strength, not I can't because of a personal weakness, right?
Yeah, there's a lack of honesty sometimes and all that.
Oh, sure,
you
sure.
Because you just assume, you just eventually tell yourself the lie. And you believe it.
Sure, it could be self-deception. It could be you don't realize the inner workings of kind of the dynamics of the relationship, you know, with that. So what this means is it's the hidden anxiety producing a can't in me that's making me feel stuck instead of strong, right? So I think the African, I probably have this in a slide, but the African Violet Lady, I think, is a good example. Her shame, well, I can't go to church anymore. Like, this is too bad, it's too embarrassing. Her shame kept her from being connected to church anymore. And then that just facilitated the whole depression. Whereas I think if she'd fought through that and stayed connected to people instead of letting the shame control her, then that would have facilitated better relationships. Yeah, have it?
So when I was in college, all of my roommates were out on dates on a Friday night, and I was not. And I was with this older woman at the congregation, bemoaning my lack of a date on a Friday night. And she said, if you wanted to have a date tonight, you could. And I said, no, nobody's asked. She's like, lower your standards. And then she went in, the guys that my roommates were out with, would you date any of those guys? I'm like, no, they're idiots. And she's like, there you go. You have more power here than you think. Yeah. It's like, oh my goodness, you're right. And it never occurred to me.
Like, yeah.
I just lower my standards and have a date whenever I want.
Yeah.
But if that
should we
really,
ask your husband about that?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I set my standards. I didn't marry till I was 28, but I did my standards. But I think that is so true because I was coming from a place of I'm not enough. This isn't happening for me. To a place of no, I really do have some freedom and some choice
in
this situation.
Yes.
And it made a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and so, and that could be an example of kind of that downward spiral of, so I put myself in a situation where only 1% of guys are whatever for me.
Yeah.
I don't even realize that. Well, here I am then without a date, and then all the depressed thoughts of me, I'm not enough, nobody likes me, and kind of whatever. Yeah. Yeah. So those things so often feed each other. So here's what is helpful is, if there's a situation that is looming, if there is a difficulty, and I've been thinking of it as an external can't, it could be actually, the problem is it's an internal can't, right? External can'ts are hard. They really are. When I can't do anything about it, that's hard. The example I use all the time with guys is I've been trying to paint my basement for years, and I can't. Like, I literally can't anymore because of Julianne's asthma, the paint fumes. I would need her to be gone for a few days. I don't want to send her away for a few days just to paint the basement. But like, you know, I delay the project. Oh, good, we're making progress. And then when her asthma hit, and she's like, "Can you not paint like the basement anymore?" It's like, okay. So then I just stare there at the walls. I stare at the big paint the 5-gallon thing I bought that I can't use. It's just depressing, right? Then you get over it. Then you get through it on the other side. You're like, I'm at peace with the basement walls as they are, right? But so that external can't is hard when you're stuck. But what if it was, I can't paint the basement because I'm too whatever. I'm not enough. Or it's like, what would, and you name all those things. Well, that's even worse because it's a self-imposed thing that's very painful, right? So inner stuckness is when my anxiety, my shame, my addiction, maybe without me realizing it, is keeping me stuck, right? My anxiety is keeping me stuck. My shame is keeping me stuck, like the African Violet Lady. I feel enslaved to that inner bully voice, those emotional hangups, and that's keeping me from moving forward. And I may not even realize that. I might think it's an external thing that's making me stuck, but it's really me, and that's miserable to live with. And then, of course, further damage and depression is because those emotional hindrances keep me from doing the things that would help me, right? Yeah. So a classic example, the African Violet Lady whose self-imposed shame kept her from being connected to people, but she didn't see that. But like, theoretically, she could have said, you know what, I don't care what people think. I'm going to go back to church, even if I'm in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. But that emotional hang-up, she needed someone to kind of meet her in that, right? And to help her through that, or for her to see that and grow out of it. Yeah, Laura, did you have a hand?
No, I was just thinking throughout all of this, just a thought keeps coming back that we are just so complicated, interesting, that it's like there's two of us.
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
there's
yes.
There's like
yes.
The self, and then there's mm-hmm. the self that talks to the self. It's like we
the
we
things just, that I want to do, I don't do. And the things I don't want to do, I keep doing. I think someone said that once. Yes, yes, I think you're right. Yeah, exactly. Wretched man that I am. Yes, exactly, exactly. So no one wants to live their life being yelled at and controlled by the anxiety bully, or being trapped in the same room with the shame bully. Like, of course you're going to be depressed. And that's the thing. Some people, you know, years ago, Gary Fisher told me, he said, you know, usually the people that are most critical of others are very critical of themselves, right? Okay, I was like, okay, store that away. Like, that's a good piece of advice. But what's going on with so much of that is this anxiety or shame or control bully is not only in you needing to control other people, but then it's yelling at yourself as well. So it's no fun to be trapped in the same room with a shame bully or trapped in the same room with the anxiety bully. And no wonder people with OCD are depressed when you have a mean person yelling at you all day, right? Mm-hmm. So the internal cant is much more depressing than any external cant. External cants are hard. I can't leave my job, like I'm stuck in this. But even worse is internal cant. You can have a good attitude about an external cant. What's super depressing is being stuck with a semi-self-imposed inner bully, right? So for this reason, in many ways, freedom is the opposite of our dysfunctions, right? The freedom to, you know what? I could run away and join the circus. I'm not stuck in this job, but I'm gonna choose to work hard, support my family, love them, care about them, do what the Lord wants me to do. And I'm not shamed into keeping my job. I'm not depressed into keeping my job or anxious. This is what I want to do. I'm going to serve the Lord, and I've got a job, and I'm going to work hard, and I'm not going to go join the circus. Like, that's what I'm going to do. That freedom is very freeing. That's the stupidest thing I've ever said. That freedom is, there's a joy with it. There is a hope with that. And, you know, that's this freedom that we find in Christ, right? The freedom of the glory of the sons of God, Romans 8. So that freedom is the very opposite of our dysfunctions. Okay, so wrapping this up. When we can rationally look at our thoughts, see that they're rational, and you do our best to replace them with the truth, right? As we said about shame, change the story you tell about yourself. You tell yourself about your life. Change the story you tell yourself about your life. See yourself how God sees you. Very true for shame. Obviously, shame and depression are going to be connected because who wants to be stuck with the shame bully, right? Notice bad thinking and just do what we can. It may be hard. You need to be like the CBT therapist in Tuscaloosa who had to tell herself every day, right? I'm going to keep telling myself the truth here. Notice that bad thinking. Fill yourself up with God's truths. When we can't be rational, keep doing the right thing. You know, it's like, I can't think my way out of it, but that's okay. I can at least keep doing the right thing. I can do productive action. I can keep moving forward. And this will then help us think better. Your good choices will help you over time to be more rational. So again, we covered that in the quarter. So to wrap up again, ending with Proverbs 15:15, like we started. All the days of the afflicted are evil, but the cheerful of heart has a continual feast. Life is miserable when we're feeling afflicted. That's the point of the proverb. All their days are evil, especially when we have afflicted hearts. The afflictions of the heart are one of the great burdens of life. There's the power of negative feelings versus the positive emotions of the cheerful of heart has a continual feast. So as much as we can, let's pursue being cheerful of heart and do what we can to make those steps in the right direction when we're burdened in these hard ways. Okay, so those are my slides. Any comments or questions
did you
before
say
to wrap
you
up?
Did you present all this last quarter?
No.
This was
I did not.
Presented. Okay, all right.
Either quarter, yeah.
Okay.
I did a survey the first quarter and said which of this stuff was the most helpful for you. And it was mostly spread out. There were some things that were more emphasized on the feedback than others. But one comment was, hey, can you focus more on depression? So I had that in my mind. I didn't get to it the second quarter, so that's why I was like, okay, let's do that the second quarter. Okay, comments or questions? Yeah, Heather.
On the slide where you had the ups and downs, I found a quote one time that said, hope has a warrior quality.
Yeah.
You talked about the downs wearing away hope and the ups.
Yes,
up.
Yes.
And it's really helped me to have that visual of hope having a warrior quality. Hope isn't something I just have or I don't. It's
yes.
Something I'm fighting
yes.
for.
that's Lamentations 3 and Psalm 42. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to choose this, right? So there's a the Christian, the preacher we support in North Carolina, David Kipp. He's very open about before Christ. He was an alcoholic. And he still has, through the years, helped at AA meetings. But you know how it is. It's hard to, life's just busy. But he has, you know, tried to go back and be at AA meetings and try to help people. But he's very open and honest and about the alcoholism in his past. And so over COVID, when the world was crazy, turned upside down, he started just a Facebook group to post encouraging things for people. And the name of the Facebook group or page that he started was called The Victor's Trudge. Mm-hmm. It's that picture of, it's a daily uphill trudge, mm-hmm. but the victor keeps going. And so his stuff on alcoholism or addiction on that page was very encouraging to me, not because I was addicted to alcohol or heroin or something like that, but just through anxiety things and probably depressed things as well, like, don't give up, keep going, you know, tell yourself the truth, all those things. So, and I told him that, you know, afterwards I was like, that page you started, that was great. So yeah, so the hope has a warrior quality, kind of the victor's trudge idea with it. Okay, good. Anything else?
You didn't mention much throughout this about singing. Mm. I think singing is a bio, social, psycho.
Yes.
I may have those out of order.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Spiritual composition.
I agree. Any other thoughts with that?
Looks like
I just think it's very valuable for us to do that, because in that we're telling God things.
Yes.
We're telling our heart things. We're uplifting ourselves out of things. It's just, for God to tell us, you know, we think that simple, oh, God commanded us to sing. Well, why don't we do that? You know, it all fits in.
Yes. So.
He hasn't posted anything since the 2020, but.
Oh, the Victor's Trudge?
Yeah.
Okay.
It looks like a lot of really
good. Oh, good, good, good. Yeah, I haven't gone back on there. Yeah, David Kipp. And so I knew him from the Northeast because he was at Fairlawn, New Jersey when we were in Manhattan, and now he's preaching in North Carolina. But so singing. Singing, Julianne loves this quote, singing is the only thing that involves our heart, soul, mind, and strength. When God says, love me with all, you know, sweeping the floor is needed, and I can love God in doing that, but it doesn't quite have the same loving God with all my mind, heart, soul, and strength, like the Deuteronomy commandment. But singing really can have that, singing out and doing that. And then music is beautiful and touches our hearts. And then singing together actually there's a release of oxytocin when we sing together. There's a bondingness of singing. People feel that of like, singing a choir or singing with people, you know, like you feel bonded to those people, you know. There's so it's
that's the second command, right? Now you hit both of them.
Yeah, love your neighbor.
You're with each other.
Yes.
You're loving them and encouraging them. And
yes. Yeah. I thought you were saying the second commandment is we join a choir.
No.
But we are. No, we're in a choir. Very good. Okay. I really appreciate you all coming out on a Saturday. I'll put this on the website today because I told a guy, I was like, if you don't see it on the website by Saturday night, text me for him to